Messages from the House.
February the 7th, 2013, from the House of Representatives. Message, third reading passed. Mr. President, the bills listed below pass the House on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 2, Oil and Gas Conservation Commission filings, ayes 60. Senate File Number 3, State Oil and Gas Supervisor Qualification, ayes 60. Senate File 10, Supreme Court Decisions and Session Laws, ayes 60. Senate File Number 12, Child Support Payment Procedures, ayes 57, noes 3. Senate File 13, Uniform Commercial Code Revisions, ayes 60. Senate File Number 15, Inmate Transfers, ayes 60. Senate File Number 18, Professional Engineers and Surveyors Practice Act, ayes 51, noes 9. Senate File 8, School Capital Construction Capacity, ayes 48, noes 12. Senate File 14, Correctional Industries, ayes 40, noes 20. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Reports from Standing Committee.
February the 7th, 2013, Mr. President, your Committee Number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 175, engrossed, juvenile citations notification by law enforcement. Passed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, 28. Senators Case, Emmerich, Peterson, Von Flateren, Senator Peterson, Chairman.
Well, well, well. We've lost our majority floor leader. Mr. Minority Floor Leader.
Senate resolve itself back into Committee of the Whole.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Senator Kraft.
Committee of the Whole is back in session. The next bill for our consideration is, excuse me, Senator Emmerich.
May I have privilege of floor?
Please do.
Fellow senators, there's a group that we take for granted. And I had an incident this morning with a bill where somewhere along the pipeline into my engrossed copies, none of the amendments appeared or any of the changes, and it got all the way through into the engrossed copy and onto the web. I found it last night, and I came in this morning to see what the problem was. And I never saw a group work harder to do the right thing, to literally fall on their swords to make everything right, because before I was testifying in front of a committee, I had the corrected copy in my hands distributed, and I think we should all give the LSO staff a marvelous round of applause. They are underappreciated and overproducing.
The next bill for our consideration is House Bill Number 62. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill Number 62, Innocent Landowner Amendment, sponsored by the Minerals Committee, an act relating to environmental quality. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Mineral Business Economic Development. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, 02, Senators Cole, Cooper, Hines, and Rothfuss. Senator Hines, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Hines?
Madam Chairman, I move the from the Committee of the Whole rise to report. It does so with a do pass recommendation on House Bill 62. There are no committee amendments. And, Madam Chairman, I've been using the excuse all session that since I wasn't on the interim committee, I would assign those committee bills to somebody else. And I think I goofed up. I didn't assign this one to anyone. So I'll try to present it to you, and hopefully the committee will help me out. Innocent landowner amendments. This is an act relating to environmental quality, amending the definition of an innocent owner for purposes of immunity from liability for contamination on real property as specified and providing definition. As we go through the bill on page 2, it gives the definition of bona fide prospective purchaser, which means a person who acquired property of contaminated real property after January 11, 2002, which the person knew to be contaminated at the time of acquisition and can establish each of the following. First, all release of disposal or disposal of contaminants located at the real property occurred before the person acquired the property, that the owner or prospective purchaser stopped all continuing release contamination, the owner or purchaser prevented any threatened future release from existing contamination, and the owner or purchaser prevented or limited human, environmental, and natural resource exposure to previous released hazard substance. And the department has been notified in writing of the presence of the contamination. The prospective buyer is not potentially liable or affiliated with a potentially liable party for response cost of the, at the property through a family, contractual, corporate, or financial relationship, or the organization of a potential liability business. The date of January 2002 was set, I believe, because that's when the when legislation was passed previously by this body that addressed this issue. On the bottom of page 3, we have the definition of an innocent owner, which means a person who did not cause or contribute to the source of contamination or who is one of the following. And the following includes a lender or fiduciary who owns or holds a security interest in the land, unless that person participated in the management of the site at the time the release that caused the contamination, or a unit of state or local government which acquire ownership or control through bankruptcy, tax delinquency, abandonment, or other circumstance. So basically what we're doing here, if someone have purchased a property or now owns property that has been contaminated, that we will issue that person immunity if he meets all those conditions, which I just went through, which is on the bill. I think that's basically the bill, and if there are questions, I'll try to answer them, or I call on my committee to help me.
Discussion? Senator Scott.
Madam Chairman, my question is, does the previous owner remain liable, or is, by selling the property, does the liability get extinguished and it becomes a public burden? How does that work?
Senator Hines.
Madam Chairman, it is my understanding that if the previous owner is available, he is still liable. And I could be mistaken. Some of the other committee members may have more information on that.
Additional discussion? Question having been called. All those in favor of Senator Hines' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill number 62, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill number 62 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 63. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill number 63, State Primacy on Greenhouse Gas Regulation, sponsored by the Minerals Committee, an act relating to public health and safety. It was referred to Committee number 9, General Business Economic Development, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Anderson, 02, Senators Cole, Cooper, Hines, and Rothfuss, Senator Hines, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Hines?
Madam Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it does so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 63, State Primacy on Greenhouse Gas Regulations. This is a committee bill, and I've done my work, so I'm going to yield to Senator Bebout.
Senator Bebout.
You may not want to have said that there, Mr. Chairman. Madam Chairman, this is an old friend, member of the Senate. It's the State Primacy on Greenhouse Gas Regulation. Just a little background to refresh your memories as to the purpose of this. You may all recall that in 07 there was a Supreme Court case that was called Massachusetts versus the EPA, and it said, in fact, that greenhouse gas regulations could be regulated under the Clean Air Act. And that particular decision had a lot of ramifications. In 2009, the EPA had a finding that the emission of these greenhouse gases may be driven by to public health and a cause of public health, and they went into the prevention of significant deterioration and came up with a lot of different rules and regulations dealing with greenhouse gases. Madam Chairman, one of them dealt with whether you would have what's called FIP, which is a FIP implementation policy, for the EPA, or SIP, which is a state implementation policy. And I believe it was in 2011 that the state of Wyoming was notified by the EPA that you had to make a decision whether or not to be included under SIP or FIP. They gave us about 2 weeks to make that decision. There was also another complication that arose that came to light when the then Governor Friedenthal looked at what we should do as a state, and that was the Kyoto Protocol language that was put in our statutes in 1999 that said, regardless of what happens, we will not take into any consideration decisions made at Kyoto Protocol relative to greenhouse gases in Wyoming. So for the combination of reasons, Madam Chairman, the state elected not to go with SIP and was forced to go into FIP, which was a federal implementation plan. Madam Chairman, what that does, that means you have dual permitting. Under the state implementation plan under Title V, there's certain requirements that you as a company that has to do in order to receive your Title V permit under the state plan, under the DEQ, that has primacy agreements with the EPA, but you would also have to go through the EPA because we have a federal implementation plan. So we had dual permitting. And there are a lot of reasons why that is not a good idea, Madam Chairman, and I'll give you a few of them. Under the construction permit, can it begin if the permit has been appealed? Under the DEQ, yes. Under EPA, no. Where is appeal heard? Under the DEQ, it's the EQC, the Environmental Quality Council. With EPA, you have to go to the Environmental Appeals Board of the USA, EPA. Is the permit application subject to ESA, NHPO, or federal executive orders? A lot of terminology, but all of them bad for the people wanting to do the permit. And under the DEQ, the answer is no. Under EPA, yes. And, of course, the time involved and the expense. So, Madam Chairman, what we did last year is we had some legislation to sort of set up the framework that we could move forward on whether or not we would go to a SIP, a state implementation plan, on greenhouse gases. And if you look at your statutes, you can see under 3511.401, And there's like B through M. You can see the language you put in there. And part of what happened, Madam Chairman, is the state sued the EPA under the SIP requirements they placed on us in FIP. That was in abeyance. We had some other language in there that said if, in fact, Congress should pass some legislation that told us to do these things, rather than have the EPA try to do it by rule and regulation, we would change. And a couple of requirements gave the governor the authority to do that. But what that bill also said is, okay, DEQ, assuming that we move forward in this, go ahead and start the rulemaking process. So what we did is we set up everything, and this, by the way, took a lot of hard work by a lot of people involved in the governor's office, the Minerals Committee, industry, and the Department of Environmental Quality. And what you do, Madam Chairman, when we get to the bill, what it does is none of the litigation has been settled. Congress hasn't changed the laws on whether or not greenhouse gases are regulated under the Clean Air Act. So what this bill simply does, Madam Chairman, it says we are going to go ahead and become a SIP, a state implementation plan for Title V under the greenhouse gas regulations. So the state will have primacy, so we will not have dual permitting. We won't have a federal implementation plan to do the Title V on the greenhouse gas side for the 100,000 tons a year of CO2 emissions. We'll have one permitting done. The DEQ will go to the EPA and get a primacy agreement with them. And that's what the purpose of the bill does, Madam Chairman. The one thing that's very important in it, if you look at page 2, line 22, we wanted to be sure and put in our law, and we say this in most everything we do, that we have primacy with the feds. In no event shall any greenhouse gas emission regulations, we add new source performance standards, or potential to emit thresholds promulgated pursuant to subsection E of this, be more stringent than those imposed or required by federal law. You know, we understand the federal law has some strict regulations and limitations they want us to do. We will certainly meet those. We will not exceed them. And, Madam Chairman, if you go down to page 3 on line 13, this is we repeal because the language allowed the governor to do things that I just mentioned to you he will not be doing now because none of those came to fruition, that being the lawsuit or a change in Congress. And then we repeal the repealer section. H1I, 2I, M1I, and 2 is repealed. And that, again, is the language, and I'll read it to you, Madam Chairman, exactly what that says so there's no confusion. It authorizes the governor to certify the Secretary of State the occurrence of any act. This is saying that either the Congress passed the act differently or we potentially had the litigation was won on behalf of the state of Wyoming. So when it's all said and done, Madam Chairman, if we vote this bill forward, we will have rules in place and move forward, and our state DEQ will now have primacy under a state implementation plan of the greenhouse gas of the rulemaking procedures that the EPA has put on us. And there will only be one permitting, one-stop shop permitting for Title V under what we already do with the DEQ and under what we would have done under the federal implementation plan. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Further discussion on the bill? Question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Hines' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill number 63, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill number 63 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for... Senator Bebout.
Madam Chairman, may I have privilege of the floor?
Please do.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I would like to take this opportunity to introduce to the Senate, and I think you all know, most of you know her, certainly my senator from Park County does because she lobbies him, or maybe he lobbies her, but my sister, Ruby Calvert, is here. They're having an event tonight for Wyoming Public Television. Ruby, welcome.
Welcome. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 80. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill number 80, Healthcare Provider Retention Program Sunset Date, sponsored by the Transportation Committee, an act relating to the Military Department. It was referred to Committee number 8, Transportation Highways Military Affairs, who reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Cooper, Escobel, Landon, Schiffer, Von Fladeren, Senator Von Fladeren, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Von Fladern?
Madam Chair, I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report to do so with a due pass on House Bill 80 and to explain this fine bill to us. I'd ask you to recognize the senator from Laramie County.
Senator Esquibel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bring to you House Bill number 80, Healthcare Provider Retention Program Sunset Date. And it's basically a simple bill. The only change is that it changes the sunset date from 2013 to 2017. But in terms of the reason for extending the sunset date and the importance of this program, I have passed out some information to you. It's called Healthcare Provider Retention Program. Now I'll go over some of the highlights briefly for the benefit of our hearing public. The Healthcare Provider Retention Program was created to incentivize healthcare providers to remain in the Wyoming National Guard during a period of high operations tempo by paying for medical malpractice insurance. This is the only incentive for recruiting new doctors into the Wyoming National Guard. As stated previously, presently the sunset is June 30th, 2013, and the present bill would extend that to 2017. And that's what the recommendation is, add 3 years to the sunset date, utilizing the existing funding. Healthcare Provider Retention Program, that began in July 1 of 2009. All monies not expended, encumbered, or obligated shall revert to the general fund. The way the bill is now would be on June 30th, 2013. But, of course, if the bill passes, which I'm hopeful that it will, it'd be on 2017. The appropriation back in 2009 was for $154,000. $27,523 has been expended. And thus far, unobligated funds are $126,477. Number of eligible providers, 9. Number participating, presently 4. It was created to provide assistance to qualified healthcare providers actively serving in the Wyoming National Guard for reimbursement of medical malpractice insurance premiums. This program is administered by the Adjutant General. It's a one-time reimbursement of medical, dental, and optometric malpractice insurance premiums. And the way that works is for a two-year service contract, 50% of the total cost of the premiums, up to $15,000, would be paid for a healthcare provider. For a four-year service contract, 100% of total cost of premiums, up to a cap of $30,000. And it's based on the most recent calendar year of the term of service contract and have to be a resident of Wyoming. As far as who's eligible for this, the healthcare providers is defined in Wyoming Statute 27-14-102A-10. Doctor of medicine, chiropractic or osteopathy, dentist, optometrist, podiatrist, psychologist, or advanced practitioner of nursing, active within the scope of his license, licensed to practice in this state, or in good standing in his home state. Officer in good standing in the Wyoming National Guard or currently fulfilling requirements to become an officer in the Wyoming National Guard. And that's what the program is about. It's an incentive to retain medical providers in our military. So with that, if there's any questions, I'll try to answer them. Otherwise, I would ask that you vote favorably in favor of House Bill 80.
Discussion? Question having been called. All those in favor of Senator Von Flader's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill number 80, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 80 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 110. The reading clerk will read the bill. Mr. Minority Floor.
House Bill 110, Off-Road Vehicle Gasoline Tax Distribution Sunset, sponsored by the Travel Committee, an act relating to gasoline tax distribution. Be It was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, Cultural Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Barnard, Burns, Christensen, Kraft. Excuse, Senator Driscoll, Senator Burns, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Burns?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 110, Off-Road Vehicle Gasoline Tax Distribution Sunset. There are no standing committee amendments, and for further explanation on this bill, I ask that you call on the good female fairer senator from Rock Springs.
Thank you, Senator Burns. Senator Kraft.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. This bill, House Bill 110, would remove the sunset date for the off-road vehicle gasoline tax distribution. What is happening right now, it was scheduled by this piece of legislation to sunset on June 30th, 2013. What this bill would do is remove that sunset date. And what this is the statute provides $10.40 in gasoline tax for each off-road vehicle that's registered under the statute. And they have a formula that they base that dollar amount on. Now, this money, along with the off-road vehicle registration fee, which is $15, is used to fund the operations. It's the operations of the off-road recreational vehicle program. It pays for the trail's crew trail building. It does repair and maintenance projects. It does safety and educational programs, grants to land management agencies, improves routes, improves access to the multiple use of our public lands for our recreational user, and it provides basically 40% of the program's operating funds. They're also used for partnership grants to provide on-the-ground work that benefits trail use. And they're typically provided, these grants are typically provided to federal agencies, such as the Forest Service or the BLM, to help provide off-road vehicle management. This particular year, they have expanded the grant program to include planning costs to assist agencies in expanding off-road recreational opportunities for the users on federal land. This would, as I mentioned, remove the sunset on the tax. The tax was enacted in 2003, was extended in 2008. That's basically the bill. I would stand for any questions and urge your favorable consideration.
Thank you, Senator Kraft. Any questions on House Bill 110? Any discussion? Seeing none, calling for the question. The question is on the motion by Senator Burns that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 110, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The House Bill 110, has passed the Committee of the Whole.
The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 250. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill number 250, Public Employee Retirement Plan, sponsored by the Appropriations Committee, and Act Relating to Public Employees. It was referred to Committee number 2, Appropriations. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Dockstader, and Meyer. No, Senator Haster. Excuse, Senator Perkins. Senator Bebout, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Bebout?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, I move in the Committee of the Whole Ryan report to do so with a do pass recommendation to House Bill 250. There are no standing committee amendments, and I'll yield to my colleague from Goshen County to explain the bill.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Ms. Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, this is a bill that goes into the retirement plans of the big plan, wardens, Highway Patrol, Capitol Police, and firefighters, and increases the contribution rates for a 0.5% in 1 year, another 0.5% in the second year, makes it a total of 1%. with the exception that's in the big plan, and that, Madam Chairman, is over on page 2. And we do have a carve out there for the Air Guard firefighters. They're caught back up in that carve out over on page 4. Then, Madam Chairman, we also bring the brand inspectors on in and over on page 3. They're part of the big plan. And again, that's a 0.5% and a 0.5%. So we'll have a 0.5% this year, another 0.5% next year. The state pays for the first 0.5% of the employee plan, and then the employer 0.5% is in the second year, and the state pays for that. If you look over on page 5, that's the Highway Patrol, Game Warden, DCI, and Capitol Police. Madam Chairman, this plan is because of the demographics and when these folks are going to retire, this plan is going to need substantially more contributions to the retirement system, and that moves it up to a 0.9% and does the same thing in 13 and 14. Again, the state pays for both the employee and the employer shares. If you go over on page 6, the 15-5-420, this is for the Fireman's B plan, which is cities, counties, and fire districts. This plan is in considerably better shape. There's only a 0.225% increase for the employee. Of course, the cities, towns, and counties have to take care of that themselves. Then in Section 2, we get into the appropriations in that, where the state actually pays for these different plans. In the judicial branch, we pay up to $994,000 for the state executive, legislative, and judicial branch employees, up to $221,000 for community colleges, $551,000 for UW. We pick up the teachers in the big plan in subsection B on page 7 for $3,750,000. The teachers are roughly half of the big plan. That's why that number is so large. Then, Madam Chairman, that pretty much explains the bill as far as how it works. I'd stand for any questions as far as any of the rest of the details. But, folks, the reason for this bill, that explains it. But the reason for it is simply this, is that we have a new actuarial system, a new actuarial report, and they changed the way the demographics are. And we also are expecting a change in the assumed rate of contribution, or the assumed rate of return, rather, from 8% to 7.75%. Now, the way we work the demographics today is that if somebody was hired 20 years ago, there's an expected flat lifespan. If somebody's hired today, we have that same lifespan. It's like retirement plus 25. But we all know that we're living longer. So what the actuarial change is this, as far as the demographics, is that if you go to work today, it's 25 years plus 25 years. If you go to work a year from now, it'd be like 25 years in 1 month. And so that's where the big change is that we know that we have to make these retirement payments longer. And that's the huge change that the actuarial folks decided that we had to make. And so this is in response to that. Now, I'm going to tell you, this is just the first shoe or the first walk outside the door, the first step, because to make these plans 100% by 2042, we're going to have somewhere around a total of 4% contributions increases over the next 4 to 6 years. Now, I realize that was a snapshot in time. If we have a huge spike in the stock market, that's going to help. But we look at a five-year averaging or smoothing. Now, next year, we're going to look a little bit better because 2008 falls off, and we'll get a slight uptick for a while. But who knows what the stock market is going to do next year or the next year. So we look at a long-term range, a 30-year range. The 30-year range tells us by 2042, if we do nothing, we're about 84% funded today, we'll be under 60% funded by 2042 if we do nothing. And that's the difference solely in the actuarial changes that I spoke to you about earlier. So it's very important that we get a start on this. It's going to cost us across the state, all employees, both in the big plan and all other plans, that it's going to cost us somewhere around $18 million for each percentage point increase. And that's the employer-employee share. If you go 1% up, that's the 1% of your payroll. So you can expect down the road here in about 4, 5, 6 years, we've got $72 million that we're going to have to come up with. This is just the very start of it. I think it's a good start. It's a significant start. It'll start moving the trend line in the right direction. Rather than being flat and going down, it'll start to nose us back up and gain a little altitude and it'll be flat and going up. So that's the reason for this bill. Essentially, it's just a half a percent and a half a percent. There's a lot of discussion. Should we just go 2 and 2 and get it over with? But we fell back to this position partly because of the budget constraints that we have today, partly because that's a pretty big sticker shock if you start moving it that fast, and partly because an actuary really is just somebody who has the best guess compared to what numbers and information that they have, and that this is a snapshot in time because it can change with the markets and other things. So I hope that we move this bill forward, but I just wanted to make sure that you were forewarned about the importance of making sure the trend lines are starting to move in the right direction.
Discussion. Senator Bebout.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. Just to add a few comments to what my colleague from Goshen County has been talking about, and what we did when we looked at the entire employee compensation plan, and we talked about that. It's in the supplemental budget bill that we'll be having on third reading tomorrow, and the amount of money we did there and how we did that. Part of the discussion was to, in fact, include a contribution to them on their behalf for the employment, for their retirement plans. And there was a two-prong approach to that. One is, as my colleague talked about, that the actuarial soundness of those plans are something that we need to be very conscious of. And in fact, if we don't do something, we could see them slip to levels we don't want them to be at. And the other part is just strictly from a dollars and cents line, that if we in fact contribute to their retirement plan, we don't have to do all of the matches for the FICA, FUTA, and those kind of things, and it saves the state some money. The thing that we got to be very careful of, and I want the body to understand, is the cost of this. And the way the bill is now written, if the employer, that be the state, picks up all of the half percent this year and the half a percent next year that we're talking about. And that's also included for the K through 12 for the teachers as well. And that price tag, if you look out there for 15-16, the next biennial budget, assuming the bill stays the way it is, which is the state being the employer picks up the half percent both years, will be for the state's share of that, it'll be about a $10 million. It'll be in the standard budget, a $10 million increase to state's funding, to state spending. And for the K through 12, outside the foundation program, it'll be about $17 million a biennium. I just wanted everyone in the body to understand those numbers. And we probably ought to have some discussion about maybe we split that with the employee. Not sure how people in this body feels about that, but there may be an amendment that deals with that. The other thing, in order to come up with the funding for the first year, and if you look at the back of the bill, it talks about the $1.76 million that's in there. We took that from reversions on the group insurance plan. If you look on page, on the fiscal note, second paragraph, it says, No, wait a minute. It's down there. It said of the total 1.76 appropriations that's from reversions that we had for the state legislative and judicial branch employee contributions. So we took that money came from that reversion, and so you don't see it as a general fund increase at this particular time. But that's the purpose of it and why we did it. The main reason for the bill, Madam Chairman, is, of course, is a concern we have for the actuarial soundness of the plan.
Further discussion? Senator Scott.
Madam Chairman, I believe I heard correctly that the actuary had lowered the expected return from 8% to 7.75. And my question is, assuming that's correct, is that enough? Are we deluding ourselves to think we can earn 7.75 on that? Or, Madam Chairman, do we still have a hidden problem in there because the returns are actually significantly less than that?
Further discussion? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, on that, I'll give you kind of an update about how that rate is determined. You have two sections of it. Part of it is inflation, and part of it is net return. And you add those two together, and that gets you your assumed rate of return. And so it's been brought out, and I think we heard it last night, that for the foreseeable future that we're going to have some lower expected inflation. Now, it depends on how you structure this as to how much cost it's going to be to the actuarial system. If you structure it and say that, yeah, we think the inflation is going to be lower, however, you have to look at it on the 30-year period. Now, if you look at it on the 30-year period, we're actually at 7.75. We're actually over what the expected rate of inflation is if we drop it down 25 basis points. So we have some cushion there as far as what the experts tell us on inflation. However, Madam Chairman, I'm a little skeptical of the experts about what might happen in years 15 through 30. So we left some cushion there on what the experts said. Now, on the other part of it is, do you expect a net return of 4%? Now, you can look back and say, well, in the stock market, that it's always been over 8% over the last 30 years. I think it's about almost 10 to 11% over the last 30 to 50 years. However, Madam Chairman, I think that a lot of us feel that maybe we're in a new paradigm where we're not going to get that same growth in our economies in the future. Now, the question is 7.75 low enough? Well, I can tell you, actually, the actuary said that they would think maybe 7.5 would be more appropriate for the future. The board has come back in with a recommendation of 7.75. Now, I can also say that about 20 of the states are at 8% or higher. Most of the states are in that 7.75 to 7.5 range now, and there's some, a few lower than that. So we are below the mean at 7.75 of all the comparable public plans in the nation. So we're in the ballpark and a little bit more conservative than most of the states at 7.75. But the trend line is, in most public plans, to lower that rate of return, that expected rate of return. And then you have to make up your mind as to whether or not you're dealing with, you lower it by inflation or lower that by expected rate of return. If you lower it by inflation, it actually helps you actuarially because you assume that you have less inflation pressure on wages. If you lower it by an expected rate of return, then you don't assume that there's going to be any alleviation of wage inflation within the system. And you expect that is all going to come from rate of return. Now, the board hasn't made a decision as to whether they're going to take that equally out of rate of return and inflation or entirely out of inflation. But essentially, That's a very small part of it. It just it helps you a little bit if you take it out of inflation, but it isn't really that significant. You know, it's like maybe if you raise the contribution rate by 0.2% or something, if you look at it from that standpoint over 30 years. So, you know, is it low enough? You know, I can say that this is something that will be revisited if it continues to look like we've had a paradigm shift on what we can expect on rate of return. I can tell you that we're exceeding that rate of return this year, that we're doing better than 8% this year. But on average, over 30 years, that's what you really have to look at, is whether or not you could reach that 7.75.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I think I just went to dinner again last night, for those of you that went to watch the Federal Reserve lady to speak. The bottom line is this, I think, from a layman's point of view, and correct me on the numbers, but generally we ask for the cost if we wanted to close the system today. And, folks, the significance of that is the cost to close the system if you want to close it and say no more, and then we want to go into a defined contribution plan instead of a defined benefit plan, was about $1 billion. What that tells you right now is, as we sit here today, we are underfunded, or the state, the large big plan is underfunded by $1 billion. And then looking forward, the question is, are we actually building to that $1 billion deficit, or are we eroding away from the deficit? And my concern when I heard their report is that in an environment where people are lucky to get 4 and 5%, because we know what our permanent mineral trust fund is getting, we're getting about 5% return. And in order to reduce that deficit to $1 billion, the actuaries have had to lay in and put in about a 7% plus rate of return, which is probably 2% higher than most yields predicted by anyone else. So last year we said, look, let's keep watching this. We've got to decide whether we're going to put more money in it. At some point you have to decide, can you afford the system? Now remember, the big plan is not the liability of the state. It is the employee's plan, and the state has no obligation to pick up those deficits. Now we may choose to do it, but it's very clear under the statute, the retirement plan, it's a defined benefit plan, and it's the employee's plan, and the state has no fiscal responsibility. And yet at the same time, we want to make sure that contributions are being made at a level. I mean, I think there's a lot of us that believe, I'm one of them, that a defined benefit plan is a good mechanism to keep employees, make sure that they have retirements. The difficulty with a defined contribution plan is employees aren't good at necessarily about planning for their own retirements. You give them the money, and the money's all gone, and they come back, the legislature says, well, you need to contribute more to my plan because the money's gone. And we saw that happen, frankly, with state employee health insurance contributions. Long after the employees were retired, they came back and said, our premiums have gotten too high. Will you contribute? The first year, the legislature said no. The second year, a few of us said no, and by the third or fourth year, we were paying a contribution to state employee health insurance retiree benefits. I mean, how many of you folks that have retired can go back to your employer, whether it's a private company, and say, oh, you know, my premiums have gone up, would you help pay it? So that's a pretty good benefit. So in this instance, we know that the present contributions will not bring the plan, or the present contribution level will create a larger deficit. So the JAC recommended, let's begin to immediately look at this. And when you begin to talk to your state employees and you go home, one of the reminders is that we are paying more for our wages. Remember the last time we did a 10% reduction? Within 2 years, our payroll costs were higher. And the reason was because while we did a 10% reduction and reduced the positions in state government. We had to increase contributions to the state retirement plan, and the cost of those extra contributions exceeded the savings that we had by position elimination. This is a very expensive program. One of the things that's happening is, if you all are probably familiar with the law enforcement plan, where we contributed 18%, and they have an early retirement system, this plan is now going to be contributing close to that rate, the law enforcement plan. And you ask yourself, how do we get in this? And we know that we got into this with the big plan three different ways. We gave cost of living increases when we couldn't afford it. We increased the multiplier rate, that is, the multiplier against every month of service that defines your benefit, when we couldn't afford it. And we failed to build a large enough reserve to pick up the stock market loss. And we have already increased premiums, I think, by 2.78% about 3 or 4 years ago. We're finding that's insufficient to take care of the problem. And now we're having to come back and do another 1%. When you begin to look at our employee programs and our salaries and whether they're competitive to the private sector, whether they're competitive to other states, always remember the entire benefit package, which is a very good health insurance program and a very, very good defined benefit program, one that we still know we may be looking at extra contributions. And my colleague to the right, what he's really saying is, folks, this additional contribution will only work if the stock market picks up. If the stock market picks up and we start picking up gains in the corpus, maybe things go away. But if they don't, we got a problem that won't end now. So let's hope for everybody's retirement that that's the case. What I'd ask the committee to do is to give us a spreadsheet in the next couple of days to show us the three areas of contributions, so we could see what – we ought to see the spreadsheet for all the plans, so you can see all the plans, what the contribution rates are. We have a spreadsheet that shows how much the plans are underfunded, whether it's 70%, 60%. We ought to see that to remind ourselves where we're at. It'd be nice to know before and after these contributions. Another thing it would be nice to know is that in the contributions, we have three categories of contributions. We have employee contributions, where the employee physically pays the amount out of his check. We have employee contributions that the state pays the employee share. And that started happening about 15, 20 years ago, when we had 5.5% for employee contributions, 5.5% for the state employee contributions, and then when money was short, the state gave the state employees a raise by picking up their contribution. There was a benefit to the state because the employer FICA was lower. There was a benefit to the employee because it's non-taxable income. And then we have another category, and that is the state share. And it looks to me like this is being divided between 0.5% would be the employee share, designated the employee share, but the state's going to pay it, and 0.5% that the employee, that the state actually pays. I think that's what I'm reading, but I'm not sure. And we ought to see a final table if that's the case. So you're seeing a 1%, 0.5% to be paid by the employee, but we were going to pay that, and essentially that's a pay raise. Non-taxable pay raise to pick up their retirement benefit, and then the 0.5% the employer share that we're going to pay as well. And we ought to see a table in the end that shows where we started from and where we're going to end up.
Senator Landon.
Madam Chairman, with apologies, I really appreciate the majority floor leader and hope we can pick back up on that. But with my apologies, would you allow me privilege of the floor, please?
Certainly, Senator.
Thank you. I didn't want to miss the opportunity to recognize some special people that we have here with us today, Madam Chairman. We have some of the best young students in Wyoming. They come from central Wyoming, Natrona County. They're our Casper homeschooled students, And sorry we missed the first batch, but they're right up here. If you'd help me welcome them to the Senate, please.
Welcome to the Senate.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Landon.
If I could be granted just a few more moments. We have other special people with us. Partly personal, I'd like to, fellow senators, introduce someone to you who is pretty dear to me. She's my boss. She's the vice president for student services at Casper College, and she allows me to come down here and hang out with you. So would you please welcome Dr. Joanna Anderson to the Senate. Yeah. Madam Chairman, Michaela Moore is our outstanding student for Casper College. She is here with the Vice President. She's one of those being honored tonight at the Community College reception. So welcome Michaela to the Senate as well. Yeah. And finally, folks, I think we have an awful lot, several community college trustees with us here in the Senate chamber, and I hope you'll join me in welcoming all those trustees from the colleges. They'll be around this evening, and many of you know that. So welcome to our trustees. If you would please stand, and we'll welcome you. To the Madam Chairman, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Landon. Senator Meyer.
We will get all of the graphs and the tables, and we've got some three-colored graph lines and indicator lines as far as what you make different contributions for, what's the results out the 2042. Now, we're primarily talking about the big plan, but I want to drop a couple more shoes here. One, and you remember I said that we brought the one plan up to 0.9%. That was the Wyoming Patrol, Game Wardens, DCI and Capitol Police. Folks, we really should do two contributions of 3.6% over the next 2 years if we're going to get these folks up. Now, really, we're starting to get up to over 30% contributions in this plan. And this is a rich plan. The board is going to have a sit down and talk to these folks, say, you know, you've got some discussions that you have to have here this summer about, do we continue to have the same structure because there's a limit to what the state's going to pay for you. So we have to have that conversation. The board's going to have the conversation with the members of that plan. This is a relatively new plan that we brought in a few years ago. That's going to be a hard one. And the one plan that's not on here is what's a closed plan. And that actually kind of brings into the conversation the paid fireman A. This is a closed plan. There's about less than 300 people in it. I think there's maybe 6 people that actually contribute to it now. That plan's in the red, $42 million, actuarially $54 to $57 million on market. And this is a plan to refresh your guys' memory that all the big towns had their own fire departments years ago. And they had a situation where they couldn't afford it anymore. So they got together and they said, well, what if we roll it into a state plan? And a bargain was struck because they had some really rich, I guess their retirement was structured on not their current salary, but the current salary of today's firemen. So they had an automatic inflation thing built into the wages of the firemen when they retired. And then there was also COLAs on top of that. Well, the bargain was is that we'll roll it into a state plan and we'll guarantee these guys 3% COLA, automatic guaranteed 3% COLA. Now, if you took the COLA away, the plan would be fine. That was an option that was presented in other chambers. That option fell on deaf ears. But, you know, at the end of the day, when the last guy walks out the door, and we don't, as a state, We don't have any responsibility constitutionally or otherwise or statutorily to make up that $42 million. But folks, I tell you, at some point in time, we're going to have to address that. And that's basically the unfunded liability in that. And the unfunded liability that the good senator from Albany County talked about is well over $1 billion in the big plan. So, you know, this bill, I think, it starts to address that unfunded liability in the big plan. And we got plenty of employees in there to make the thing work. So I would hope that that we move this bill forward and start addressing the problem again.
Senator Hicks.
Madam Chairman, just a question for the good senator from Goshen County. The way I read this on page 5, this deals with the Highway Patrol game wardens under 63604. The way I read this, the state's going to pick up, or the employer, which is the state in this particular case, is going to pick up both the employee's contribution and the employer's contribution. Is that correct?
Senator Meyer.
Thank you. Yes, that's correct, and that's correct on all of these plans, that the state picks up both of it. And the good senator from Central Wyoming talked about that briefly, was that it was cheaper to do it that way for both the state and the employee, because otherwise we would have had to have paid FICA on it. Both the employer and the employer would have to pay FICA. And so, you know, we're saving about, between the two of us, you know, 15-16% there. And then there'd be those would be taxable events to the employee. And so the employee is saving money by not having to have those taxes, and those taxes are deferred to the to the retirement benefits. So, and that was the discussion that the good senator from Albany County talked about years ago when we couldn't afford to give raises. We started paying the retirement because we were able to deduct those FICA charges, and it made sense at that point in time, and frankly, we felt that it probably made sense today. The other thing is that because we essentially have flat salaries, that there's a lot of discussion that if you, over the next few years, add 3-4%, or 2% would if you picked it up 50-50, and you had a 2% reduction in an employee salary, that's a salary cut. And that would accelerate the retirements into the system faster than the assumptions and the actuarial assumptions. And if you have more retirees than you assume, then you have a problem in that you're bringing people in at a lower wage, and you don't have the contributions because it's based on a lower percentage of that wage. I mean, on the same percentage, but a lower wage rate. And that exasperates the problems as far as actuarially being sound, because you take a big block of employees out and you're paying retirement benefits at them on a high wage. You bring new people in at a lower wage, and you got less contributions because their wages are lower. So that was the discussion that we had and why we decided to pay both parts of the retirement.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And folks, I'm on and for the bill. I'm in favor of the bill, but I do want to make sure folks are careful about the language they use and careful to understand what brings us here, where we're going. And I think it's important for you to understand it, so as you have conversations with state employees, you can have them on a level that is meaningful. But a couple things. First of all, when you hear that the bargain was struck as to we'll move you into one plan out of the counties, there was no bargaining. Absolutely no. There are no bargainings. The state has always said these are your retirement plans, and we are not financially responsible for them. If they fail, they fail. The state's credit, if you will, is not on the line. Now, you may feel as members and our successors in the future may choose on their own to fill in the gaps, to appropriate money if there are deficits. They can always do that, but there is no obligation. There is no bargain. The statute says we're not liable for these funds. But as employers, it is in our interest, as well as our employees' interest, to make sure and do everything we can to get these things back to funded to 100% level where we were. And unfortunately, what ended up happening is each time state employees came in and they said, we think you can pay a higher COLA, cost of living increase. And along came the actuaries. The actuaries said, the plan can afford it. State employees said, we would like to increase the multiplier against which we calculate our monthly or our retirement benefits. The actuary says, the plan can afford it. In many of those, I was sitting on the JAC when we made those decisions. And then when we found out we're $1 billion under, we brought new actuaries in and they said, well, what's the deal? Well, you didn't ask the right questions. What you should have asked is it actuarially sound over the lifetime of your members, which is about that are likely to take benefits, and that's 30 years. And you're like, really? That's, you know, I really thought that's what actuaries would tell us, is what questions to ask. Now, remember when we did our last bill, we put in some bunch of language in it, and we explained the history of it. So in the future, when we're all gone, all you have to do is go read the statute, and it will lay out this history. And it further states in the plan that, and we articulate once again in that last bill we passed, that this is not a financial obligation of the state. And you have to be careful when you're giving cost of living increases to ask for a 30-year amortization. You have to be careful when you make these changes. And we also change the benefits for new employees. So an employee that's coming on today will have a lower benefit than the employee retiring today. And the employee that starts today is going to be paying for the cost, the overcost of the retirees, which is really unfair. That means I get to start out today paying for somebody else's retirement. But it is what it is because we have to move forward. And it was easy to do because they're not represented. They weren't hired yet. Now, with respect to this issue about the state picking up the state employee contribution, it's true that in about the mid-80s, I want to say, when there was no money, and at that time, I think our state salaries were generally about 60 to 70% of market, well below the regional averages. And the people were trying to find a way to get money to employees and said, we'll pick up that other contribution. But we never changed that. Even when we got employees up to 90% of market, we didn't go back and unravel that. So they were getting 90% of market without relationship to their retirement plan, and they had a great retirement plan and a great health insurance plan. Now, we've fallen off the 90%, and that's disappointing. I wish that we could hold the 90%, although these calculations move up and down. But it's important to realize as you move forward that the elements that caused us to say, will pay your share of the contributions was in an environment where their salaries were closer to 60, 70, or low 80% of market. And when we reached the 90% of market, we didn't change the rules and say, okay, now that you're getting paid more, you ought to start picking up your share. And if for those that are in the private industry like myself, as I get aging and I realize I have to put more contributions into my 401k, I get a pay reduction. I know I'm going to get my money back later, but to suggest that that's a pay reduction is insane. You're essentially taking part of your salary, deferring it to a later time. It's not a pay reduction. It's simply saying we're going to require that you take part of your income now and for the future, and you're going to defer that income, and that's not a pay cut.
Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and my apologies to the good senator from Goshen County if he's already discussed this, but I just was wondering what the return on investment was on that account, on our retirement accounts.
further discussion? Senator Meyer.
You know, Madam Chairman, I know that it's well over 8%. I'll have to take a look at it there and see. We've been running in the sevens. I think it's around 11.5, but I'll get the exact number of what it is for this year. I think it was a little less than the 8%. On average, where we're looking at as far as the mix of assets that we have right now in our asset allocation, I believe that's pictured at 7.78, I believe, is where we're at on our mix of asset on our allocations. And folks, I want to tell you that there's been a lot of work on asset allocation over the last 3 years. You know, we put a lot of money into the, I guess, the positions at the retirement board for different people with some expertise, and we got some good people at some fairly good salary rates compared to what we could have got them for 10 years ago after before the crash. So we got some good folks working for us. The asset allocations are much more diversified than they were before, and it's a structure that's setting up that even if you have a stock market decline, we're not going to get hit like we did in 2008 because of that diversification. And so it's more of a balanced portfolio. So irregardless of what happens, you're going to see some downturns in a down market, but you're not going to see the 35% and 40% type of a downturn that we had before. It's going to be much less than that. So, you know, it's not that you can sleep easy in this environment, but let's say you're not gonna have the losses that we had in the previous era.
Further discussion. Senator Schiffer.
Yes, Madam Chairman. On my question is on page 6, line 16. Starts on 16. And we're funding the general fund portion of this out of reversions, and as I recollect, reversions, and when they revert, they'll stay in till the end of that year, and theoretically they go into the general fund. If this is going to be an ongoing obligation, why are we funding it this way? Is that? It seems to me it ought to show up in the general fund allocation so that we know this is and as near as I can tell, this is a continuing obligation that we'll have, and maybe even increasing later on. Is there any particular reason why it specifies it comes from reversions instead of general fund?
Senator Meyer.
Madam Chairman, there's no particular reason. I think the discussion was that this is money that's going to go into the general fund anyway. We just picked it up before it got there because we could identify that coffee can. The good senator from KC is absolutely correct that this is an ongoing obligation of the state. It's the way the statute is written now, and it's the same money. It's in the left pocket or the right pocket. We just took it out of the left pocket before it got to the right pocket. And so, Madam Chairman, it's a six and one half a dozen or another, but he's absolutely correct. This is an ongoing expense.
Senator Schiffer.
Madam Chairman, another question. I don't even know if it's available. In terms of the sharing this contribution, did you get any, and I'll just use the surrounding states, I don't care what the sample is, what do other states do with their contributions? Are they like us, where do they pick up 100% of it? Are they 50-50 or 41-10 or 87-102 or where are they at?
Chairman, I don't know if that information is readily available. I can tell you at these rates, we're probably still under the average of the other states as far as contribution levels. We'd probably have to get up into that 18%. But what I will do, Madam Chairman, is that I'll get the chart of the other states that are around us as far as what their contributions levels are. I know that's readily available. If we can get that information as to what contributions are paid by the state and what are paid by the employee or the employer employee, if that's available, we'll get that if it's out there. It very well may be out there. I know we haven't seen it lately on the board, but we do have all the other states, so you can see what the surrounding states are, and we're moving up to about where they are, and probably will be right at where they are with the implementation of the 4%. So all over the course of the next six years or so. So I'll get that information, guys. This will be a pretty thick packet, and I'll be welcome to sit down and go over every detail it with you.
Further discussion? Hearing the question, all those in favor of Senator Bebout's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill number 250. Please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 250 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 49. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill number 49, Legislature Certificates of Attendance, sponsored by the Management Council, and Act relating to the Legislature. It was referred to Committee number 12, Rules and Procedures, which reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Kraft, Nicholas, Ross, and Rothfuss. Excuse, Senator Bebout, Senator Ross, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you. It's 49, right? Thank you. 49? Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 49. Folks, what this is we've gone through and eliminated some archaic language, and the two statutory provisions that are being removed here were put in our statutes in 1890. One of them was a certificate of attendance and mileage issuance of approval so that the chief clerk would issue the presiding officers certificates of attendance, although I kind of like that idea, at least for the Fremont County folks. And the attendance would be issued at time and service, and then there was a certificate of attendance for mileage for the auditor and issuance of warrants. That's a process that we haven't followed for many years. And the purpose of this bill, Madam Chairman, is to repeal those archaic laws.
Discussion on the bill? Question having been called. All those in favor of Mr. Majority Floor Leader's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill number 49. Please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Bill number 49 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 50. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill number 50, Distribution of Bills, sponsored by the Management Council, an act relating to the Legislature. It was referred to Committee number 12, Rules and Procedures, who reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Kraft, Nicholas, Ross, and Rothfuss. Excuse, Senator Bebout, Senator Ross, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Mr. Majority Floor Leader?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, to do so with a favorable recommendation with respect to House Bill 50, Distribution of Bills. Folks, this is also a house cleaning measure. This statute that's being repealed provided, it was an 1895 statute that provided for printing of copies of bills to be made to the county clerk. It's also important to recognize that the copies that were required to be sent were the pre-filed introduced copies of the bills, not the amendments or the final copies. And as you're all aware, this information is all available on the website that we have now, and for all practical purposes, providing pre-filed bills and memorials is not very informative, as it doesn't have the amendments, things that you can provide. We were told that there were a couple of clerks who would like to still receive them. We'll work with them, but for all practical purposes, information that is not very helpful. It's information that is available on the website, and so the proposal is to repeal that statute.
Discussion on the bill. Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Mr. Majority Floor Leader's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill Number 50, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill Number 50 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill Number 57. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill Number 57, Constituent Service Allowance, sponsored by the Management Council, an act relating to the legislative compensation. It was referred to Committee Number 12, Rules and Procedures, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Kraft, Nicholas, Roth, and Rothfuss. Excuse Senator Bebout, Senator Ross, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Mr. Minority Floor Leader?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, to do so with a due pass recommendation with House Bill 57. Folks, this addresses the constituent service allowance, and it clarifies an amendment that was put in 2009. And it's important to recognize it's simply a clarification, a modification, because these additional payments will become effective this year. We're not authorizing them. As you know, that if you want to authorize a pay increase, you cannot do it during your term of office. So this has already taken place several years ago, but when the history of this is as follows. The original constituency service allowance was put in a feed bill. It created an interesting controversy towards the end of the session, whether or not you could raise your or should be able to put that in a feed bill, and ultimately the resolution of that was the original constituency allowance was administered different in the House than the Senate. In the House, you had to apply for reimbursement. In the Senate, you would apply for your $750, but you did not have to itemize your amount. So there was a disparity between how they were treated. And in theory, there was a disparity about the taxability, because if you apply for reimbursement, it's non-taxable. If you simply are paid the amount, then it's taxable because it's not a reimbursement component. In 2009, our colleague from Casper College, a representative from Casper, put in an amendment to say, well, if you can accumulate your receipts, so if you in one quarter, if you use $750, you fair enough, but if the next one you would do $500, you could take the $250 and you could carry it over. In the amendments in that 2009, on the Senate side, we said, look, let's just go back to the way it was originally intended. It is essentially additional compensation, recognizing that you have ongoing expenses, so you get it automatically every quarter, and as such, it would be a salary, and that's the way it went out. Well, when we did implement it, we voted on it, and there were some inconsistencies from the original legislation, and this simply clarifies that language and implements the intent that was set forth in the final act in 2009. I urge your support.
Discussion on the bill. You ready for the question on the bill? All those in favor of Mr. Majority Floor Leader's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill Number 57. Please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill Number 57 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 13. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill Number 13, Livestock Revisions. Sponsored by the Agriculture Committee, an act relating to livestock and other animals. It was referred to Committee Number 5, Agricultural, State, Public Lands, and Water Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Driscoll, Emmerich, Geis, and Hicks. Excuse Senator Johnson, Senator Geis, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Geis?
Madam Chairman, when the Committee of the Whole rises and report, I move that House Bill 13 do pass, and I'd like to have the Standing Committee Amendment read in.
House Bill 113, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, to engross copy, page 3, line 10.
Madam Chairman, I would move the Standing Committee Number 1 to House Bill 13 and yield to Senator Driscoll to explain the bill.
Senator Driscoll.
Madam Chairman, yes, you moved the amendment. This bill's a kind of a cleanup bill and adds just a little bit on as far as some livestock revisions pertaining to sale barns and some other stuff. I'll kind of walk you through it quickly as I can. On page 2, it's got a couple new statutes added into the thing. Those are further down in the bill. If you look further down, it explains what they are, their penalties. Under the license cancellation on sale barns in the state of Wyoming, in the past, all they were able to do was to revoke a license. They couldn't do either fines or suspend a license for a time. This merely makes it where they can do fines, suspension, or cancel them. This will, on page 3, on line 10, this is the amendment. It says, Livestock Board shall require, and we added a monthly report from brand inspectors, related to all Wyoming livestock markets, and then on line 12, we got rid of a monthly report, just kind of a wording type deal. Added branded and unbranded instruct calves and beef breeds that are not accompanied by their mothers. These are old laws that go back to almost statehood times that really don't apply to sale barns at this point in time on livestock prior to the sale. They also redefine on line 15 as such calves as livestock, once again, because calves now are all different sizes. Going to line 17, the reports will report the total number of inspected livestock, got rid of calves, once again. Moving on to page 4 on this, it's into the stray part of the law. They struck out the penalty part of that, and that goes back and puts in one of these new statutes, brings the penalties up to date, makes them consistent with other places in the law. Doesn't get rid of the penalty, it just moves it to the correct spot in the law with the new one. Then you start moving into the horses and stallions and jacks generally, 1124-104 on page 4. On line 15 and 16, they were $30 expenses was all you could charge. Well, this day and age, that amount of expenses greatly exceeds that at times, particularly on numbers. So we have added the language says expenses occurred for the feed and care of the animal. Just brings it up where you actually can get back to even on it. Dropping down at the bottom of page 4, line 24, and carrying over to page 5, the owner of the horse or ass shall be liable for any damages caused by the animal, the property, or livestock. This is a new provision in there. Particularly when you get into horses, you can get into some actual damage, and this makes it where you can be compensated if there's a actual damage with it. Dropping down, you come into a new section in the middle of page 5, unclaimed horses, permit for gathering and disposal. They struck out that you have to, on line 8, must obtain written permission before commencing to do so. And we added new language, says, shall obtain a permit from the Livestock Board except as provided in subsection E of this section. The permit, strike out, must be the applicant. Must submit the permit application with written permission to access the range whereupon the unclaimed horses are to be gathered and struck obtained. This just gives them permission to go out on private ground and gather horses if they're out there and legally do that on private ground. Goes on through a little definition on it. Then on line 16, lines 15 and down, says strikes whereupon the unclaimed horses are to be gathered, permit presented to the inspector, be used for the base issuance, any brand inspection, removal. This language just is moved up above in what I just told you about. Moving to the bottom of page 5, if after inspection, subsection C, rightful owner cannot be found, or when found. This whole section goes back to getting money back out. And I can read it to you, but you guys have got a bill in front of you. Cleans it up, makes it where you can actually get money back and who can do it legally. It does tell you you have to have a permit and you have to have permission if you're going to gather horses on your private property. I'm going to drop down in page 6 to the middle of it. Once again, back to the amendment on line 16, we've made it clear that it's private ground, and again on line 18, it's private ground. Just clarifies exactly where that falls. Moving on to page 7, says that your determination, ownership, and responsible expenses required to gather, feed, and care of end claim horse till inspections occurred. Tells you you get a hold of a brand inspector, you tell him you got horses, you're going to get paid back for what they cost to gather them and to care for them. Section F on line 4, any horse claimed by the U.S. Bureau of Land Management belonging to wild horse management is excluded. This makes it where you can't go gather wild horses even if they're on your deeded ground. It's only horses that are actually strays. Dropping down to section B, which is stock, goes to the stock at large or picketed on public highways. On line 14, they struck not less than $50, and on line 14 and 15, moved it to $200. Just getting it up to modern times, $50 doesn't even come close to what it does. Same thing on section D. Used to be when you took stuff off the highways, up to $10 a head you could charge. They moved that to $20. It's just getting it into modern times. Same way at the bottom of line 7 and going across, same thing. And they made it clear that it's for expenses incurred for the feed and care of the animal, so you can't just go bill when you take something, pull it off. Drop clear down to the middle of page 8, monthly report of the inspectors. Every 30 days, all strays, and it used to say not otherwise reported to the Livestock Board. Just make sure that they do report all the strays they have in there. Cleaned it up. Moving on to page 9, this has to do with the distribution of money on and how you prove ownership if you have an astray and the timing of it. In the past, the Livestock Board has done their astray lists on a yearly basis, and it left a lot of times that it was a pretty short period. They've moved this and added the language on line 5, said at the end of the calendar year in which the disposal occurred. It actually gives guys a little longer to be able to find that astray on the list. Dropping down to 9, at the end of the calendar year of what had occurred, proceeds remains unclaimed. The proceeds will be disposed of as law. It just gives that ability for that money to be there a little bit longer. Then it moves on to the publication of the list of unclaimed astrays, and you move on to page 10 for the new language on it. This section says not less than once each month, the board shall ensure that if a new stray is taken up, notice post the courthouse, the county in which the stray was taken. Livestock market. The other new portion of it is notice under this subsection shall include the location recovered from and the name of the inspector. And this is for ease of someone, if they got something in your county, you can actually call that inspector and find out whose place it came off of and whether it might or might not be yours. Also, make sure the courthouse lists are kept up so you can find them. Moving on to line 12, prohibited generally, liability of the owner and penalty. This is probably the meat of what is the change of this. Line 16, they have now defined or exotic livestock to be added when you gather the thing. And it defines the exotic livestock as used in this section, exotic livestock, non-traditional livestock, animal, including without limitation, llama, alpaca, and other camelids, ostrich, and other rarities, ray types, bison hybrids, and yaks. So for those of you guys that got the wild yaks out there, they're now exotic wildlife, and you can be liable for costs when they go to gather them. We've had some bills on that before. Moving on to the last page, finally, that merely moves the penalty again. Used to be fine not less than $10 or more than $250 for each offense, and this moves it back into that same penalty deal that makes the fines can be quite a bit steeper. 1131.214, they added on line 11 the state veterinarian and Department of Health. This broadens it out a little bit so they actually can take care of it. That's the bill. I would move for adoption of the amendment and the bill. That's for any questions. Oh, yakky.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Yakety yak. I've actually just wanted the privilege of the floor to remind folks that your budget amendments have to be in by 5 for tomorrow.
Thank you so much. Senator Hicks.
Madam Chairman, just a question for the sponsor on this. How would I go about if I had a horse that got out on BLM ground? How do I go about getting a permit from the Livestock Board to go gather that horse?
Senator Driscoll.
If it's on your private ground, I believe you can if it's not a wild horse. The way I read this law, on private ground, they can issue a permit. But we've specifically excluded wild horses from this part of it. So it's going to lay on you to convince the local brand person to issue a permit for a horse that is not a wild horse. How you define that, I'm not sure.
Senator Hicks.
Madam Chairman, the good senator, it would be a horse that was a private horse that escaped onto federal domain within a wild horse unit. How do you get a permit to do that?
Senator Driscoll.
Senator Hicks, from the land of much BLM and wild horses, I'm going to have to ask somebody to answer that one.
Senator Case.
Madam Chairman, did it matter if that horse was of a different color?
Senator Scott.
Madam Chairman, you got a stray horse in your pasture that you don't know who it belongs to. Normal procedure would be just run it into the corral, call the brand inspector. Do you have to now go through a fancy permit system to do that, or do you just take care of it and call the brand inspector to find out whose he is?
This clarifies what's been in statute, and no, there's nothing to stop you, best of my knowledge, from gathering a horse and pendant. This does make it where you can get, which is rarely done, but it does make it where you can go ahead and get paid for the feed and whatever it takes care of it before they come get it, assuming it's an astray. But no, it doesn't stop you from gathering it.
There's further discussion on the amendment to this bill. I'm ready for the question on the amendment. All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill Number 13, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion is carried. The amendment has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Is there further discussion on the bill? All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 13, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. House Bill 13 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 21. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill Number 21, Peace Officer Immunity, sponsored by the Judiciary Committee, an act relating to peace officers. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, and Schiffer. No, Senator Hicks, Senator Schiffer, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Schiffer?
Madam Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rise to report it do so with a favorable recommendation for House Bill 21, Peace Officer Immunity, and to explain this bill, I yield to Senator Christensen.
Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Fellow senators, this is a bill that really talks about some history. Right in the center of Wyoming, we have our Wind River Reservation. Over the course of the years, when I was involved in law enforcement, and the challenges continue, and they existed before that, when you had an incident or a request for backup assistance out on the reservation, your municipalities, your sheriff's office in that area would respond. They did it with a fair amount of uncertainty. They had opportunities, different times when they were special deputies or special officers for the reservation, the BIA, And there's been some evolution back and forth, and things would work for a while and then they wouldn't work. Well, we're trying to resolve that with Senate File 21, add some clarity on that. It's the intent on this bill. I'll address the amendment if I can. Have we read the amendment in?
No, we have not.
Please read the amendment.
Would the reading clerk please read the amendment?
House Bill number 21, Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to engrossed copy, page 1, line 3.
Senator Christensen.
Madam Chairman, thank you. I'll work the amendment in as we go through. Move the amendment. I move the amendment, and I'll address it as we go through it. Really, when you look at it, this bill is just about one paragraph in the statute, 72106C. And the amendment is really a lot of the change in paragraph C. But starting out on the first page, the first part of that will be on page 1, line 3, up to the title explanation. After the word reservation on line 3, we add language that says requiring agreements between specified parties specifying the courts in which the claims may be brought. And the reason for this was there was always some concerns out there with your federal, a 1983, a civil action, civil rights action, that heads right away for the federal courts. But everything else, there was some confusion on, do we go to the Indian courts, do we go to the tribal courts, do we go into the county courts? Where's this going to end up at if there's a challenge out there involving the law enforcement officers that provided the assistance and came onto the reservation? So we'll go down to the bottom of page 1, here on line 16, and we'll just address the new language. Everything else is existing, but the underlined language for this bill on line 16 is a peace officer when providing law enforcement assistance on the Wind River Indian Turnover Reservation, and then we will insert on line 19 of your amendment 9, line 9, right after the word reservation, be pursuant to a memorandum of understanding entered in advance and approved by the Attorney General between the Department of Interior, Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs, or the tribes, and the state, county, city, or town providing assistance. And the intent of this portion of the amendment is just merely to get everybody on the same page, have an agreement before we have an action out there, before the law enforcement, state or municipal law enforcement officers go out onto the reservation into that nation. The language continues with existing language under the that addresses that they'll be deemed to be acting within the scope of their duties in the Wyoming Governmental Claims Act and the state self-insurance program or the local government self-insurance program. Then on line 5, we'll bring in another large insert from the amendment, starting on the go to the amendment on line 17, right after the statute 1-42-206 period. We'll bring in the new language from the amendment on line 17. The memorandum of understanding shall contain a provision for immunity from suit in tribal court for activities occurring pursuant to any law enforcement assistance provided under this subsection. Any suit relating to those activities shall be brought only under the terms of the Wyoming Governmental Claims Act in the state district court having jurisdiction or in the federal district court for the District of Wyoming if appropriate. That's really the meat of it. And those are the big issues. And again, it helps clarify if there's a challenge, if there's a complaint or a suit, where that officer's actions are going to be challenged or discussed. The bill continues down to, back to the bill on page 2, on line 11 with new language, and it just adds in, and shall apply to peace officers when providing law enforcement assistance on the Wind River Indian Reservation. Again, clarifying where, and that this is specific to that location and the officers that are assisting out there. And then the last piece of new language off of the amendment, if you'll go, it begins on line 13 of the bill after reservation, period. And then if you'll go to the amendment on line 30, and it is pursuant to this subsection. That's all of the information for the amendment, Madam Chairman.
Is there discussion on the amendment? Are you ready for the question on the amendment? All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill Number 21, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Senator Christensen.
Madam Chairman, thank you. The bill, as amended, really goes to answering a lot of questions and concerns for local law enforcement. It doesn't resolve all the issues that take place out there, but this was part of an interim conversation that we had, and feel like this is a great improvement, adding clarity and specificity as to how they'll resolve any conflicts between local law enforcement and the tribes when local law enforcement is on the reservation giving assistance. And with that, I'll stand for questions on the bill.
Discussion on the bill? Question having been called. All those in favor of Senator Schiffer's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation for House Bill Number 21, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill Number 21 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill Number 37. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill Number 37, Hunting License Raffle, sponsored by the Travel Committee, an act relating to game and fish. It was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, Cultural Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Barnard, Burns, Christensen, Kraft, and Driscoll. Senator Burns, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Burns?
Madam Chair, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 37, Hunting License Raffle. There are no standing committee amendments, and for a further explanation of the bill, I ask that you call on the sage of Devil's Tower.
Senator Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. There is a
There is a Committee of the Whole amendment.
The whole amendment. I would ask it be read in, if I could, please.
The reading clerk will read the amendment.
House Bill 37, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 2, line 21.
Senator Driscoll.
Madam Chairman, I would move for adoption of the amendment. I'm going to explain the bill, and then I will hand off on the amendment to the good senator from Baggs.
Senator Schiffer.
Chairman, I believe the protocol says that whoever brings the Committee of the Whole amendment brings it after the presentation of the bill, and he moves it, asks it to be read in, and moves it. Standing committee amendments, it's who presents the bill. That's kind of the way we've always done things, but, you know, it's a new day. Who knows? It might work better.
Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Schiffer. Senator Driscoll.
I apologize to the great Senator from KC. Did not know the procedure well enough. I retract my motion. Hunting license raffle. This is a great bill. This brings in a raffle for the Game and Fish Department that allows them to actually sell raffle tickets for big game species in Wyoming, and it actually, as it's done in the bill, will be two separate raffles. One raffle will be for each of the five main species of game, and it will be for one license only of those, will be resident or non-resident. Elk, sheep, moose, deer, and bison. And those will be any species of the animal in any area that has acceptable numbers. Now, they do have some areas that don't have enough licenses available, so those areas will not. The second raffle is for a trifecta, as they explained it, which would be a big three, and you can pick any three of those five species if you are the winner of this, and you get all three of them. You get to hunt them anywhere in the state. The other part that's a big part of this bill, there's no more than two licenses issued in every year. So Obviously, or very likely, you're going to have a mountain sheep license, and the trifecta is probably going to take a mountain sheep license as well as their tough. But only two of any species in any deal. You can get these with the non-5-year restriction on moose, sheep, and bison. They've got restrictions with these. There is no restriction. You can have hunted a mountain sheep the year before, and you can win the trifecta or the sheep raffle and be right back and be hunting them again. It's not a problem the way it's set. So this is really a nice deal. It's being done in a number of other states. I call it the Hicks bill because Senator Hicks kind of came up with it. It's really a nice way for the game and fish to raise some funds, allow some hunter participation. Does not affect your points either as well. If you're in a point system and you've been building points for any of those species, this does not change your points and does not reset them. You're still just in. This is outside of any of the rest of it. With that, I will ask for...
We have a committee...
Do you have any questions?
Okay. Senator Esquivel.
Not a question. I just want to add something to what a good senator mentioned in regard to this raffle. Is that, as you mentioned, there's other states that have something similar, and apparently, I don't know if it was Wisconsin or Minnesota, one of those places, had something similar, and an individual that won the raffle happened to be about $20,000 behind on his child support payments. Surprisingly, well, of course, he wasn't eligible because of being behind on his child support payments to be given that, even though he won the raffle, he couldn't use it because of the child support payments. But surprisingly, he came up with his child support payments soon thereafter. So this might have some other benefits.
Discussion? Senator Driscoll.
Thanks for that. Also, the one provision I did not talk about. If you're an offender of game and fish laws and you're on their list, you do not qualify. That doesn't happen to be there. But if you're banned from hunting, you're banned from hunting.
Further discussion? Senator Hines.
Madam Chairman, explain the raffle. I don't see anything in there that just is that left to rules and procedure. Is a raffle like I'm familiar with? You buying tickets, and if so, is there any standard for price, or is it an auction, or just how does that work?
Senator Driscoll.
Chairman, thank you, Senator Hines. The fee that was talked about in committee, I believe, was $30 for the trifecta raffle and $10, I believe, on the other one. But that is settable by the Game and Fish Department. And they will vary that. They've talked about it. They're not sure what those fees are going to be, and they will vary them up and down to sell the biggest number they can. The idea is to raise money for them. So those fees could go up or down depending on where the sweet spot's at for doing it. And we've left it open for them as far as rules and regulations that fall within this raffle. We didn't get deep into whether licensed selling agents sold them or anything else. It merely gives them the tool to use, and they can formulate the rules to work within it.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, as a follow-up in answer to the good senator from Campbell County, on line 13, page 2, you'll see that the commission may, by rule and regulation, establish a process. They will make the rules and actually set the prices. The prices that were quoted by the senator from Crook County are, I believe, that's the plan for the initial fee. We don't know how successful this thing may be. I suspect, and it was mentioned in committee, that especially that trifecta ticket may actually be underpriced because you can choose, you can get three licenses for any of the five big game in the state. I think that's going to be an enormous draw, and I think $30 may prove to be too cheap.
Further discussion? There is a committee of the whole amendment. Senator Hicks.
Madam Chairman, I would move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 37. Members, I'll just explain this real quick. Under 23-1703, when it comes to moose, sheep, goat, and grizzly bears, the Game and Fish Department is statutorily obligated to on a percentage basis, segregate those between resident and non-resident. All this says is that if there's any permits issued underneath the raffle, that they would go against the non-resident portion designated in statutes to be accredited back to the non-resident account. I'd stand for any questions.
Any questions or discussion on the amendment? Ready for the question on the amendment? All those in favor of Senator Driscoll's motion to adopt the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill Number 37, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Further discussion on the bill. Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill Number 37, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill Number 37 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill Number 40. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill Number 40, Eminent Domain Wind Energy Collector Systems, sponsored by the Judiciary Committee, an act relating to eminent domain. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Schiffer. Senator Schiffer, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Schiffer?
Madam Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rise to report. You do so with a favorable recommendation for House Bill 40, Eminent Domain Wind Energy Collector System. Madam Chairman, what this bill does, it goes over, it's actually on page 2, line 4, and extends for 2 years the moratorium for eminent domain on wind energy collector systems. Madam Chairman, a little bit of history, if I may. This is an extension. They've had 2 years. The groups involved have had 2 years. They're working on how do they approach a system of eminent domain for wind collector systems. There are a number of methods to do that. Just to give you a couple examples of what appears to be the road they're going down, one of them would be if you got a certain percentage of the landowners in the open market to sign surface use agreements, then the remaining percentage, say, and I'm just making up these percentages, if you got 85% of the landowners on a wind collector line to go on it, the other 15% would be on it at the same terms and at the average price or whatever it is. They're working on details like that. The other alternative that they seem to be working on is to say when there is a collector system proposed, that it will be much like unitizing a mineral interest. You will go on the percentage of rods that you, for the appropriate landowner that you have, and the payout, you would get whatever your percentage was for that. Those seem to be the two foremost issues they're working on. They are still working on it. What we're saying is keep going. Go ahead and work it out. Work out a system that works between the surface owners and the people that want to build a collector line. Let's give them a little more time. Experience tells us that if we can get agreement amongst the entities that are really involved in this arena, we'll come out with a good system. So that's what we're asking for, is 2 more years to let them work it out.
Further discussion on the bill? Question having been called. All those in favor of Senator Schiffer's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill Number 40, please say aye. Those opposed, no. House Bill 40 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
I move the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You have heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carried.
Nothing to read. Oh, we're going to do rollbacks. Okay.
Nothing else other than that.
Signing of enrolled acts. Wait, I forgot.
Yeah.
The reading clerk will read the committee of the whole report.
Mr. President, your committee of the whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. House Bill 82, do pass, amended. House Bill 2, do pass. House Bill 3, do pass. House Bill 9, do pass. House Bill 14, do pass. House Bill 20, do pass. House Bill 23, do pass. House Bill 28, do pass. House Bill 29, do pass. House Bill 55, do pass, amended. House Bill 53, excuse me. Can't read my own writing. House Bill 62, do pass. House Bill 53, do pass, amended. House Bill 62, do pass. House Bill 63, do pass. House Bill 80, do pass. House Bill 110, do pass. House Bill 250, do pass. House Bill 49, do pass. House Bill 50, do pass. House Bill 57, do pass. House Bill 13, do pass, amended. House Bill 21, do pass, amended. On House Bill 37, do pass, amended. And House Bill 40, do pass. Senator Kraft, Chairman.
Senator Kraft.
Mr. President, I move for the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's carried and the report has been adopted. Now, signing of enrolled acts. Enrolled Act number 2 being original Senate file number 2. Reading clerk will read it.
Senate Enrolled Act number 2 being original Senate file 2, an act relating to oil and gas.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act 2 being original Senate file 2. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 3 being original Senate file number 3. Reading clerk will read it.
Senate Enrolled Act number 3 being original Senate file 3, an act relating to oil and gas.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act 3 being the original Senate file 3. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 4, the original Senate File 8. Reading clerk will read.
Senate Enrolled Act number 4, being original Senate File 8, an act relating to school capital construction.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act 4, being original Senate File 8. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 5, being original Senate File 10.
Senate Enrolled Act number 5, being original Senate File 10, an act relating to the Supreme Court.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act 5, being original Senate File 10. I have so signed. So then we're rolled Act 6 being original Senate File 12.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 6 being original Senate File 12, an act relating to child support payments.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act Number 6 being original Senate File 12. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 7, being original Senate File 13.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 7, being original Senate File 13, an act relating to the Uniform Commercial Code.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act Number 7, the original Senate File 13. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act Number 8, being original Senate File 14.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 8, being original Senate File 14, an act relating to penal institutions.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act 8, original Senate File 14. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act Number 9 being original Senate File 15.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 9 being original Senate File 15, an act relating to penal institutions.
About to sign Senate Enrolled Act Number 9 being original Senate File 15. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act Number 10 being original Senate File 18.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 10 being original Senate File 18, an act relating to surveyors and engineers.
I'm about to sign. What happens if I don't sign this? I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act 10, being original Senate File 18. I have so signed. Is that it? Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that the Senate stand adjourned until tomorrow at 10 a.m., which would be February the 8th.
Announcement. Senator Geis.
Mr. President, your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Land, and Water Resources, will meet in about 15 minutes up in S-15, take up House Bill 108, Food Freedom Act, House Bill 71, Ominous Water Bill Plan, House Bill 117, Administration Rules and Taking Assessments, House Bill 109, Engrossed Interstate Shipment of State Inspected Meats.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in our normal committee room. House Bill 203, Engrossed Health Benefit Exchange Study and Select Committee. We'll try to complete our work on that bill. Take up then House Bill 146, Engrossed Athletic Trainers Licensure. And then, if time permits, and I suspect it will, we'll deal with the House Bill 102, Hospitalization of Mentally Ill Persons. And then, by way of advance notice, our thought on Monday is to deal with the Immunization by Pharmacist Bill and the Chiropractor Licensure Amendments.
Senator Coe.
Mr. President, your committee number 4, Education, meet tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock over here in room S-11. to take up House Bill 105, engrossed Citizens and Students Self-Defense Act.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. President, your committee number one, Judiciary, will meet tomorrow morning in room 302. The first bill we take up, and this is a change, will be House Bill 221, State Government Fraud Reduction Act Reporting Requirements, and then we'll take up House Bill 133, engrossed Human Trafficking.
Further announcement, Senator Hines.
Mr. President, your committee number nine, Minerals, will meet 15 minutes after the noon recess tomorrow, and we'll take up House Bill 212, engrossed Impact Assistance to Local Governments, and House Bill 85, engrossed Community Infrastructure Program Amendments 2. Also, Mr. President, next Wednesday, February 13th, at 8 a.m. in room 302, we'll have a joint meeting with the House and with the Hybrid Energy System Committee, and they'll report to us on that work that they've done this past year.
Senator Burns?
Mr. President, House Bill 81, Large Project Funding, sponsored by the Select Natural Resource Funding Committee, was read in earlier, and I neglected to ask you to re-refer it to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, because it has an appropriation. If you would do that, I'd appreciate it.
Without objection, House Bill 81 will be re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Further announcements? You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Senate stands adjourned until 10 a.m. February 8th.